It's up to us. Take your positions. Caroline opened the bolt on her Breno rifle and pulled it back far enough to confirm that there was a round in the chamber. The magazine held 5 rounds of the venerable .375 H&H. Another was in the chamber ready to go. 10 more rode in a leather belt around her waist, and she'd stuffed another 10 in her pockets. The rifle had served her well since she'd first picked it up in 1971. The home was still and silent, many of the windows open to let in what might be the last warm air of the season. Caroline had positioned herself on the second floor inside a dormer window that faced the most likely enemy avenue of approach. She didn't have to wait long to hear a diesel motor and tires gnawing at the dirt and gravel road. A blue pickup came into view, its motor accelerating. She didn't hesitate, dropping into a seated position and resting the rifle's forend on the windowsill. Unlike the CZ-550 and most modern rifles, the Breno safety needed to be pulled back to fire. Caroline's thumb clicked the safety into position, her cheek dropping to the weathered Turkish walnut Lux-pattern stock, and centered the front post with the 200-meter leaf of the express sight on the driver's side window. The Breno was made in Uherský Brod, Czechoslovakia, when it was under Soviet occupation in the late 1960s. Now a rifle built in the ashes of the Prague Spring was about to be unleashed on a new Russian enemy. The heavy rifle barked, the recoil pushing into her shoulder, as her round turned the windshield into spiderwebs. Though she couldn't see from her perch, the 270-grain bullet took the driver in the throat. She cycled the bolt quickly and sent a second round through the center of the glass, which gut-shot one of the men in the back seat. The driver's foot came off the gas pedal thanks to his severed spine, and the big Ford began to slow. With their leader in violent death throes, his severed artery splattering the truck's cabin with hot blood, the rest of the men panicked. When the fourth round shot away the rearview mirror, the 4 assaulters who were still able to move bailed out of the vehicle as it came to rest. They had trained for and expected to deliver a violent ambush, not be ambushed themselves. Taking cover, they fired wildly on full automatic, spraying the large home with 7.62-millimeter rounds. With no leader, the men didn't communicate, they didn't maneuver, they didn't flank. They just hunkered down and burned through their ammunition as they continued shooting into what moments before had been a beautiful mountain home. Caroline was single-minded in her purpose, firing a single round before moving to a different room and finding her next target through a new window. After the initial volley, she was careful to stay well back so that her rifle's protruding barrel would not give the enemy a target. Her objective was to keep them pinned down so that they couldn't approach the house. If they set it ablaze or moved inside, she would lose the tactical advantage. It hadn't been a question of what to do when the attack came. It was all about executing a pre-planned emergency response, habits instilled in a different time and place, habits born of necessity in the African bush. That plan and those skills now kept her family alive. She remembered her own mother tucking her into bed and explaining the reality of life in Rhodesia.
If someone with malintent enters our property, they have declared war on our family.
These tears had declared war. A shooter found the courage to roll out from behind the truck's rear wheel, firing as he rose to charge forward. Caroline's next shot took him in the chest. She topped off the rifle with 6 more rounds as she moved into an adjacent room, looking for her next target. Chapter 45. Oleg Guskov was itching for a fight. As the youngest member of the crew, he had something to prove. The other 5 had military or police experience, albeit rudimentary, or had come of age in the 1990s, the heyday of Russian organized crime. He'd had to endure listening to their stories of what amounted to urban combat as the gangs fought for control of the new Russia, carving it up in a Darwinian contest for control of the underworld. Oleg had looked over at his boss when the bullet took Vitya in the throat. He watched as the man who had helped train him for this mission went white, his eyes bulging, mouth struggling to bring in oxygen in an attempt to delay the inevitable. Oleg felt another round as it passed between him and the dying driver, and heard Pavel grunt from the back seat. The truck veered left and ran up and onto a stump, arresting all forward progress. As Oleg watched his team leader die, the rearview mirror exploded just inches from his face.
What now?
Another round impacted the vehicle. He heard and felt the rear passenger doors open as the gangsters bailed out to find cover. Oleg followed suit, trying to figure out how to open the huge vehicle's door, groping to find the handle and throwing it open just in time to avoid the .375 round that took out his headrest. Falling to the dirt, he low-crawled to a rock by the side of the long driveway, propped himself up, and depressed the trigger. Nothing happened. He could hear his comrades return fire, spraying the front of the house with bullets. He looked around long enough to see Boris charge forward from behind the truck and take a round to the chest. Serov and Taro were behind cover, continuing to let loose with their AKs.
Ah, the safety!
Oleg pushed the safety to fire and watched as his rounds hit fairly close to his intended target, the far right upstairs window. He was surprised at how quickly his magazine ran dry. He had to move. He had to make a name for himself. If he could get to the house, he knew he could kill everyone inside. That would make the Pachan proud. Maybe he would even rise in the ranks? He remembered Vitya and Dmitri say that a moving target was harder to hit. When he heard his comrades send another long volley into the upper level of the house, Oleg got up and ran.
Stay barricaded behind this door jamb, Liz said.
They could hear Caroline or Thorne engaging from upstairs, single shots, and they could hear the return fire from outside.
You are far enough back in the room where it will be hard for anyone approaching to see you. Cover this sector here, Liz said, indicating an area of the backyard beyond the guest room patio.
Where will you be? Katie asked.
With only two of us, we won't be able to cover all the angles, so I'll be mobile. If you see anyone, take your shots. I'll come to support if I hear you fire,
Liz responded before disappearing into an adjacent room. Katie had survived two ambushes and a kidnapping since Reese had come into her life, and now she was fighting for her life. At least this time she had a vote. She had a rifle. Oleg moved through the trees. Had they seen him? He hoped his comrade's full auto barrage had distracted the upstairs shooter long enough for him to get out of the line of fire and approach the house from the back or side. He was going to get inside. He wouldn't be a shestyorka for long. It didn't happen the way she had thought. 1 second Katie was running through the possible scenarios in her head, and the next second a skinny man in a black leather jacket holding what she recognized as an AK-47 was sprinting across the garden. She tried to call for Liz, but her mouth was dry and wouldn't make a sound. When he hit the patio, he came to a stop by a pillar that helped support a second-story back deck. Katie watched him peer cautiously around the support, then creep to the glass door that led to the back guest room. He was less than 30 feet away.
Liz!
She tried again, not knowing if any sound escaped her lips. She was certain that even through the glass, the thin man could hear the beating of her heart.
Take the weapon off safe, Katie, she told herself.
She was sure the man outside heard the almost inaudible click of the safety moving to the fire position. Less than 10 minutes had passed, but still she struggled to remember what Caroline had told her.
Put the stock in your shoulder, aim this red dot at whoever tries to come across the back garden, and shoot them until they go down.
Katie pulled the stock into her shoulder. Her eye found the red dot of the optic.
Where did he go?
Her eyes traveled back to the pillar. He was kneeling, part of his body concealed by the round support. The AK was pointed directly at her. Before she could press the trigger, the glass door exploded. Chapter 46. Cresting a rise, they could hear shooting. Jonathan pinned the accelerator to the floor. We are coming in on the X, he called out. No time for anything fancy. They could already be in the house. Tactically, Rhys wanted to take the high ground and flank, but this was an in extremis situation. Katie and the others could already be dead or dying. It was time to kill. A blue F-250 sat at an awkward angle in front of the house, three of its four doors open. Two men here behind nearby trees firing sporadically at the home. They were completely unaware of the approaching vehicles to their rear. Jonathan slammed Rhys's Land Cruiser to a stop and bailed out, sprinting forward with his FAL at the ready. Knowing that vehicles quickly turned into bullet sponges in combat, Rhys opened the passenger door and instinctively took up a solid position at the base of a large rock. Rafe skidded his defender to a stop behind them and, armed with his truck rifle, a SIG SG-553 carbine, raced after his father. Rhys found a target, dropping him with a solid headshot. Jonathan fired as he moved, 10 rounds from the FAL tearing through a man at the base of a tree. Rafe had reached the truck within seconds, clearing it and putting rounds into a man in the back seat and another in the driver's seat. The three sprinted toward the house. Rhys's head swiveled up and around to take in the surrounding area, looking at positions on the high ground. Stacking on the front door, the three prepared to make entry. Visions of Rhys's wife and daughter riddled with bullets dying in a pool of blood on the floor of their home flashed through his thoughts. Jonathan's voice brought Rhys back to the present.
"Caroline," the former Cellus scout yelled.
"Annika."
"We're here, Dad," his daughter called back.
"Three coming in,"
Jonathan shouted. Zulu charged through the breach and went straight for Annika, taking up a protective position at her left side.
"You okay, baby girl?"
Jonathan asked, kneeling next to her.
"I'm fine, Dad. Mom is upstairs with Thorn. Katie and Liz are down the hall in the guest bedroom. I just heard shooting down there."
Rhys sprinted down the hall without waiting for more.
"Katie?
Katie!" Nothing.
"Katie!" "I'm here, James,"
Katie said. She sat on the bed. Liz was next to her. Glass was strewn across the back entry where the door had once been.
"Are you okay?
Stand up," he said, pulling her to her feet and looking her up and down for injuries.
"You're not hit, are you?"
"No, I'm okay."
"Don't worry about me,"
Liz interjected sarcastically.
"I'm just fine."
"Sorry, Liz. Is everyone else okay?"
"I think so."
"Well, not this guy,"
she said, pointing her rifle toward a man on the patio. There was no need for a security round, as half his head was missing.
"Liz?"
"He almost got the drop on us. Katie here did a fabulous job."
"Did you?"
Rhys asked.
"No,"
Katie answered.
"As I brought my rifle up, he fired and the whole room seemed to explode. I fell back into the bathroom. I guess he was a bad shot, or I was lucky, maybe both. Next thing I know, Liz is standing over me."
"It was just like Iraq, Rhys. It's been a while, but my self-preservation instincts are still strong."
"Thank you, Liz."
"James, I was so worried about you,"
Katie said. He could feel her body shake as they embraced.
"Come on, let's go check on the others."
Annika was in a chair at the kitchen table, and Jonathan was coming down the stairs with his wife as Rhys, Katie, and Liz entered the main room.
"Where's Thorn?"
Rhys asked immediately.
"He's upstairs, keeping an eye on things just in case. We're not sure that was all of them."
"Rhys, you're hurt,"
Katie exclaimed as they emerged into the lighter portion of the home, and she spotted the bloody tear on the back of his jeans.
"It's just a scratch, I think. Let me look.
Now?"
"Yes, now."
Rhys took a seat and pulled up his right pant leg. He jumped as she touched the wound, which had been effectively cauterized by the heat of the bullet. The round had just grazed the back of his calf, leaving a half-diameter channel as it plowed its way across the flesh.
"See, I told you it was fine. I'll dress it anyway."
"Let me get you what you'll need, dear,"
Caroline said, exiting the room. Rhys laid his own carbine on the table next to Caroline's bolt gun and prepared to endure Katie's medical treatment.
"Who were they?"
Katie asked, her journalistic mind already working to understand the events that had unfolded. Rhys looked at the others around the table.
"Not sure.
We think Russian."
"Russian?"
Caroline returned and handed Katie a plastic tub loaded with first aid supplies. She pulled her chair close to Rhys's and propped his leg up on hers before dabbing the wound with a betadine-soaked gauze pad.
"Do you know what you're doing?"
"My dad was a doctor, remember?"
"Does that mean yes?"
"Don't worry. I also watched a couple of episodes of Grey's Anatomy."
She used her finger to coat the wound in ointment before covering it with a pad and wrapping the entire calf with several loops of gauze.
There, done.
Not bad, Reese admitted. Caroline nodded approvingly.
All right, lads, Jonathan said. The authorities will be here soon. We need to talk. Why are Russian mobsters attacking us in Montana?
Reese looked at Rafe, and then back to Jonathan, and then to Katie, Caroline, and Annika.
I'm sorry, sir. It's my fault. I think they were after me. I should have known better than to come here and put you all at risk. I should have known they'd find me.
None of that, lad, the weathered old man snapped. We're all still above ground. That was nothing compared to what the Tears and Mugabe's thugs did in Rhodesia. I'm just getting warmed up. Will they be back?
If I stay, they might.
But let's also not make any assumptions until I talk to the agency. They might be able to shed some light on all this. He looked to Rafe. Remember, there were two hit teams. One was after Rafe, so unless they didn't know which one of us was which, let's not count out Rafe being a target as well. It could mean someone knows you were with me in Switzerland. Rafe looked at Annika, whose concern was more than apparent. Also, Reese continued, please check in with your other daughters. Have them go someplace safe.
He's safe here now, Jonathan remarked.
Had they hit us at night with nods, lasers, and a more capable force, standoff weapons, we wouldn't have stood a chance. We got lucky. And we were prepared for this type of an attack.
A more professional unit could have taken us. All of us. Reese looked around the room as the severity of the situation sank in.
I'll call the girls now,
Caroline said, moving to a landline next to the couch. Reese leaned across the table, his eyes intently moving between the father and son.
There's only one person who can tell us what's going on, and right now he's dying in the back of my truck.
Give me 10 minutes with him, Jonathan stated. We'll see how tough he is once I rip him in tires and start burning them.
Unfortunately, we can't do that, Reese said. Ellie has got to be inbound, so we are on the clock. If they get their hands on him and he lawyers up, we'll never get what we need.
What do you suggest? The elder man asked Reese.
Liz, how far is it to Thorne's most remote cabin?
About an hour in the Albatross. Why?
Okay. Liz and I will take Stalin out there to the cabin, Reese said, indicating the Russian bound in the land cruiser. You two get ready to meet the sheriff. Even local L.E. is going to put together that there is more going on here than meets the eye. I'll call my contact at the CIA and see if he can throw up some veil of national security to stall things. In the meantime, I've got work to do.
Reese, are you sure you want to do this?
Rafe asked. Reese looked around the room. Instead of seeing Katie, Annika, Liz, and Caroline, he saw the ghosts of his dead wife and daughter.
I think I know who's behind this. He might be after us both for taking out Andrenov in Switzerland, but I think it's about something even more personal. I need to know where he is. Our one link may already be bleeding out of my truck, so we need to move. I'll be back when it's done.
Oh, Jonathan, Reese said. Do you have any more of those homegrown ghost peppers?
Chapter 47. Infantry battles are uncommon in Flathead County, Montana, despite an extremely high rate of gun ownership. Because of this, the law enforcement response was predictably substantial. Every available deputy made their way either to the ranch or the scene of the attempted roadside ambush. The entire family was seated at the kitchen table, along with the Hastings' attorney, Brad Kale, when the authorities arrived at the house. Kale was a former Army Ranger and U.S. attorney for the Montana District and was a close friend of both the Hastings and Thornton families. Cahill's trademark white Stetson sat on the table, but, at his suggestion, the rifles were tastefully relocated. A regional SWAT team from the FBI field office in Salt Lake City arrived shortly after the deputies in a pair of Bureau helicopters, having been alerted by a call from Vic Rodriguez of a possible ambush in progress. Within hours, the ranch was crawling with armed agents, and a mobile command center was set up near the main house. With everyone they came to fight already dead, the SWAT team took